Let's see. Great. Well, we'll go ahead and get started while doing a little more sharing. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff with Atlas Society Senior Scholar Jason Hill discussing an objectivist inquiry into colonialism. I hope everyone shares the room, and please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation after Professor Hill's opening. I also want to note that Professor Hill and our other scholars will be speaking during our gala in Malibu, October 6th. I'll put up a link for tickets. Jason, thanks so much for doing this topic. Colonialism is pretty widely seen as a bad thing, exploiting natives. Is there another side?
Right. Well, there is another side. I mean, I just interviewed Bruce Gilley, who's the author of that very controversial piece called The Case for Colonialism. And he's written a number of books called The Case for German Colonialism and how it's, let's see if I can find it. I think how its rejection led to Nazism and authoritarianism. And he's written a book called The Last Imperialist, Sir Alan Burns and The Case for Colonialism. Having come from a post-colonial society myself, and I thought I would rethink it in certain terms. I'm not this presentation is part of a long 50-page chapter from a book on American foreign policy that I wrote. I'm still working on it because it needs to be shortened. It's 700 pages, but I wrote this 8 years ago, so I'm not that influenced by Gilley's arguments. The case that I want to make is that I want to focus on moral rogue nation states. And the case that I want to make is that given what Rand said about states that had so egregiously violated the rights of their citizens, such as authoritarian despotic states, and had in some sense taken themselves outside the ambit of rights. That is, they had violated the sovereignty principle because sovereignty is is subjected to constraints of justice, and in violating the rights of the people, they had relinquished their right to sovereignty. In my understanding, rogue states behave so egregiously and pose such a threat to the international world order that the moral grammar for what happens to them is not really up for grabs. They have placed themselves back into a state of nature by taking themselves outside the pantheon of moral societies through their egregious behaviors, their thuggery, their systemic violation of human rights, individual rights. So I wanted to present a case for what qualifies as a rogue nation state, and look at the idea of recolonization or colonization of such states as a way of what I call global incarceration or resocializing the political sensibilities of those states in such a manner that they would be fit to be part of the global commons. Because I'm going to repeat this again, but the problem with I'm sorry, rogue states is that they not only pose a regional threat to their neighbors, they pose a threat to the global order. Because in the age of porous and vast swaths of unmanned seas, nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and bombs, they're as likely to get from Yemen to Somalia into the hands of terrorists, East Jerusalem and London and the United States as they are any other place on Earth. So, a moral rogue state sort of violates the foundational letter or spirit of the law that binds the League of Moral Nations of the world. These moral nations need not agree on all matters of policies of governance, right? But they are united, like Canada and the United States clearly have different, and Sweden, we have different policies or about how we govern internally and how we approach, let's say, in the case of many European states, Iran. But they're united by a set of common core commitments that characterize the body of nations who are its member nations. That is free trade, free markets, human rights and individual rights, gender and racial equality before the law, bodily integrity, democracy and transparent governance, freedom of association and of religious affiliation without persecution, the right to one's conscience and the judgment thereof, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of association, the right of each individual to cultivate a life plan that corresponds to his or her values and values in the name of personal autonomy, and the right to acquire property and the right to have one's property rights protected. So moral rogue states, in some sense, reify the spirit of anarchy that characterizes the global commons by failing in many cases to ratify the international political sphere with treaties, laws, protocols, proliferations, referenda that would add law and order to it in a way that secures a lasting peace for all. So part of what I want to do is I want to abstract the features and existential qualities that all rogue nations share. That is, regardless of what action each may have committed, I want to abstract from the differences and unite under a common conceptual denominator with a view to recommending what ought to be done about them, right? So rogue states inflict a type of metaphysical harm against their victims, and the degree of harm may vary, and concomitantly the punishment should be commensurate to the egregious crimes committed. But the basic assault to the dignity, to the moral order of what I call the League of Civilized Nations remains the same. So I think we can make sense of the term even before President Clinton became the first to give it its first official coinage in 1994 in Belgium, by reference to historical behavior of any state that behaved with belligerence and without impunity to the United States. But the idea of rogue nations presupposes some semblance of order and established customary law in the political imaginary and in the international public sphere. So traditionally, there have been four transgressive criteria used to determine the nature of a rogue state. In theory, a state had to, one, pursue weapons of mass destruction, support terrorism, severely abuse its own citizens, and virulently criticize the United States. And throughout the history of U.S. foreign policy, the latter has revised its conception of a rogue state depending on political expediency and the shifting criteria that are used to determine who is or is not an ally. So I find it very interesting that our beloved ally, Saudi Arabia, a country that exponentially kills more Americans than other countries in the world, and that routinely abuses its citizens through beheadings, trials without representation, the absence of due process, the presumption of guilt before innocence, floggings, gross gender and religious discrimination, and other egregious human rights violations, is not classified as a rogue state. But as we have already seen, and we know that Saudi Arabia is, I think, the third, following Iran and Qatar, sponsor, or maybe it's a second sponsor of terrorism in its international funding and indoctrination program of its Wahhabi faith of the type that caused the elite to jihadism and wanton violence in the West. So there can be no doubt that Saudi Arabia should be a legal leading example of a rogue state par excellence. But what is clear is that the definition of a rogue state advanced by the United States under several administrations over the past decades is one that fails to capture the subtlety of behaviors exhibited by several states and nations that ought to still render them subsumable under the label rogue state. So I want to, in some sense, argue that more increased actions ought to be taken against rogue states depending on the degree of harm, evil, and threat posed and leveled by such states against those within the United Nation of Moral States, of which the United States is a member. So in some sense, a moral rogue state violates the world order on which human rights and individual rights and established protocols securing world peace are secured, because moral rogue states betray civilizational maturity by, among other things, engaging in what I would call political thuggery that engender regional destabilization, and in other forms of transnational regional upheavals that if left unchecked, threatens the capacity of leading states such as the United States of America and leading European players to enforce order and law and civilized customs and mores in the West. And the enforcement of such phenomena are crucial, I think, to the exercise of our individual rights in this country. Probably more on that later. But more rogue states left unchecked pose unchecked threats to those who fall within their own geographical ambits. They defy the individual rights of their citizens and residents in a way that undermines the judicial personalities and moral integrity of those individuals. So put formally, we can say that a moral rogue state de-ratifies the structural alignment of human moral personalities from their foundational axes. And the essence of its moral violence is divestiture of the entire judicial personality of persons through foisting a political system and or moral morality that is totally antithetical to man's rational nature qua man. So they commit egregious moral violence against individuals. And moral violence, in one sense, is a production of the material, intellectual, psychic, and other means that dislocate the individual from his or her moral nature. So moral violence is a system of political machinations that violates the inviolability of the laws of nature on which human survival rests, the inalienable rights that secure a fit between the external world and the requirements of the inner life. And it is a process by which we discover as rational creatures through reason the requirements for our survival in the external life or world, life, liberty, and the pursuit of rational happiness. So moral violence is the systematization and politicization of mores, beliefs, attitudes, and schemas that are codified ways of legally dismantling the coherency of the self by legally prohibiting the individual from creating life plans in the free service of his or her life. It is a legal imposition of a sort of soul-killing anti-life form of governance, whether it's authoritarianism, totalitarianism, despotism, Sharia law, on individuals who have no choice to contest it and no opportunity to negotiate the alternative. So moral rogue states, I think, consciously remove the possibility of a lasting peace by subjugating human beings in the global community to continuous fear by A, exposing them directly to the threat of war, B, compromising or destroying those institutions that are devoted to maintaining a peaceful world order and a balance of power among the union of moral nations and states devoted to peaceful international relations, and C, by inflicting brutality and oppression against their own people. So in some sense, you know, one of the reasons that I think China should be treated and punished, though not through colonization, which I'll get to in a little while, as a rogue state, is that it was very instrumental in developing North Korean rocketry, right? Period. So any country or state that is complicitous in the nefarious activities of another nation ought to fall under the category of either a rogue state or a misdemeanor state, depending on the degree of harm done by the practices of the rogue state. So by definition, I think, and by their existence, they're not just inimical to the world moral order, thereby political behavior, ecological, political ballast, because the very existence, their very existence in some sense, or the very existence of a domain of the global political system that they advance, I think warrants some kind of what I would call global incarceration or containment. So rogue states like criminals represent a threat to world society at large, and they need to be removed for the threat that they represent. In both cases, political resocialization, when we're talking about a criminal, remains a lofty goal, But this resocialization, I think, could result in a rogue state being inserted back into the historical process and into the pantheon of the United Union of Moral States. So it may involve removing the leader of a country by aiding an opposition party within that the members of the Union of Civilized States can endorse and respect. So rehabilitation here is broadly construed to mean establishing conditions that align the political principles of the rogue state with those of the civilized order. Rogue states like Syria and Iran, for example, that have stockpiles of chemical weapons. We saw Syria in April of 2017 gassing its civilian population using sarin gas, would be forced to have their weaponry destroyed or face the use of targeted military force against them, as President Trump did in 2017 against Syria in reaction to that country's use of chemical weapons against its own population. So when we talk about political rehabilitation, whereas when I talk about political rehabilitation, it is largely predicated on a premise of good faith that the rogue state will, in time, try to reform certain conditions believed to be central to its survivability. They are its desire to achieve eventually good standing in the community of moral nations, the realization that its proclivity for acting in a particular unilateral manner and its inability to build a coalition of support in the world of nation states will only over time undermine its capacity and strength to sustain whatever semblance of power it believes it holds, and that its global isolation and moral and political ostracism will only weaken its internal capabilities to govern, because the resources needed from the outside world, economic aid, diplomatic ties, regional coalitions that strengthen internal policies, to name a few, will be completely cut off. So, in some sense, I want to jump ahead a little bit and say that before we get to this issue of how colonization of such states is both a moral, see, I'm defending the moral right of certain actions taken against rogue states, the feasibility and the strategic maneuverings of a country, of any free society in relation to the rogue state will depend on political expediency and what that country, what any free country feels is in its rational self-interest at the moment. But I want to defend the political right of any free country to deal with a rogue state that exists, as far as I'm concerned, in a state of nature and outside the ambit or outside the pantheon of rights recognizing civilized countries. Anything that a free country society, that a free society does in terms of trying to rehabilitate or punish or resocialize is proper. To secure that moral principle. So some rogue states may be capable of rehabilitation through various measures such as trusteeship, military occupation, provisional annexation, or what I would call rehabilitation. Some like Iran and North Korea may have to just be obliterated. I don't know. But the specificities of measures dealing with the actual mechanics of, say, trusteeship, annexation, and ethical recolonization are options that I think that are worth thinking about. And we would not be violating the rights of the citizens, because as Ayn Rand said, when a free country or a semi-free country invades a despotic, totalitarian, dictatorial country, it's leaving its citizens in no worse off of a social and political situation than they had found themselves in. Quite the opposite, they're actually liberating them. I'm going to speak about how this, and then I'm going to close out after 25 minutes, how this could be in America's self-interest, economically speaking. So when we talk about first dislocating the will of a a rogue state, or to use the term global incarceration or containment, it may involve, but is not limited to, the formal dissolution of a nation's sovereignty by recognizing first and foremost the manner in which the offending state has already disqualified itself from sovereignty by violating the norms that secure it. So once a state has been divested of the status of sovereignty, it has no legal standing in the international community, and it is therefore left up to the judgment of a benevolent state, free state, to determine the moral culpability of the citizens in upholding the status of the rogue state. In other words, the questions are the citizens complicit in the criminal activities of the rogue state, willing executioners? Are they oppressed victims? Do they aid and abet a regime they could overthrow but refuse to do so? So should any free society judge by objective evidence that the will of the people is coterminous with the actual behavior of the regime? And further, should the rogue state in such a case pose an interminable threat to the global order, and in this case, international security and national security of the United States, among others, then global containment here could mean an outright war of attrition if the rogue state poses a serious military threat, or if it doesn't pose that much of a threat that would warrant a war, then I think something like permanent military occupation with a no-exit form of recolonization, in which the terms of colonization is punitive, not rehabilitative, but permanent, not provisional, as would be the case, I would argue, for states that have systematically practiced genocide, such as the Congo and Darfur, and that still practice slavery, such as Mauritania, right? So the latter, I think, is so heinous a crime against the individual that not only should it be the foreign policy of every government to have the practices eradicated from the face of the earth, but countries that are found practicing it should have their sovereignty delegitimized, and depending on the strategic importance it holds for, say, the United States or any member of the moral union of states, colonized, annexed, or military occupied. In the 21st century, I don't think there's any moral excuse for any state to be practicing slavery, and no reason for political forgiveness, nor redemption towards such states. So basically, and wrapping up in terms of what ethical colonization could do, is it would be very economically viable for a state or a set of states that pose a threat to the United States or the world order in which the United States is ensconced and is implicated. By, among other things, after it has withdrawn foreign aid, after it's sort of crippled the economy of that country, to sort of move in to manage the resources of that country and to induct that country into the crucible of what I would call civilizational mores, to bring it up on par with the civilization, political civilization, that we find in, say, a country governed by a constitutional republic, or a country governed by a particular form of democracy, not the kind of democracy that we find in Gaza, clearly, but let's say the kind of democracy that we find in Canada, in France, in England. And there is a more radical form of dealing with extreme rogue states, and I think I'll end here because I only have 2 more minutes, in that sovereign countries cannot be auctioned off, properly speaking, proper sovereign countries cannot be auctioned off or merely incorporated into the larger domains of other countries. But rogue nations that are divested of sovereignty, right, that are a fortiori demoted to a state of nature, which therefore have become part of the global commons, and as far as I'm concerned, common spoilage and taking for he or she who can refashion any semblance of the previous state into an entity that can then re-enter the historical process and allow the subjects contained therein to reclaim their freedom of subjects in a cosmopolitan world order, is going to present before us a case that is ethically permissible. And I think I'll just end there because I'm at 25 minutes.
All right, great. Well, we want to encourage other people. That was deep, rich stuff. And I've got a lot to bring up if no one else wants to raise your hand. But if you do want to, we'll definitely bring you up. And I guess for me, you started to talk about the four criteria that other people use, but there's just it. The first thing, it seems like there's just too much of a danger of if you don't have established enough criteria for it to be a tool of a corrupt global establishment to just kind of take over and declare them rogue states, and now we're coming in to, seize you for your own good.
Well, that's why I think you're right, Scott. That's why I think that there must be clear and fixed criteria as to what counts as a rogue state. It can't be just a state that pisses us off because, like, here's an example. I am appalled that there are European countries that are doing business with Iran and enabling Iran to increase its stockpile of uranium. And thereby, in the long term, prepare it to fix, to I'm sorry, to create a nuclear bomb. I think those countries should be punished, like Germany and those countries doing business with Iran. We should find ways of punishing them. But I'm not willing to say that just because they're doing that they're rogue states, because those are trading policies that they have with an enemy of ours, and it's not a sufficient condition for declaring Germany as a rogue state, because it's not. That would be ridiculous. There have to be clear. There has to be a litmus test on which is predicated clear criteria that we can check off the ones that I've listed, and falling short of those, we attempt other forms of rehabilitation or reformation. But it has to be a very, very strict, objective criteria that passes certain political meaning tests, in fact, demonstrated behavior of roguery and thuggery over a protracted period of time that has demonstrably undermined regional stability. And undermine regional stability in areas where America has vested interests, that sort of thing. So I think I agree with you that it would be just horrible to have a sort of free-for-all, highly subjective understanding of what constitutes a rogue nation, a rogue state, and then we just plunge in and, plunder and,
In the name of the New World Order or what have you. What about an example like Hungary and Orban? A lot of Western Europe see him as kind of rogue.
No, I wouldn't necessarily call Hungary a rogue state. There is no evidence to show, for example, that he's a sponsor of global terrorism. It's a nationalistic, highly ethnic nationalistic state, but it's not on the order of, let's say, Slobodan Milosevic's nationalistic, culturally nationalistic or ethnic nationalistic state in which genocide was taking place. Actually, I see Erdogan as an isolationist, someone who he just doesn't want immigrants in his country because he thinks that they're not, and not without good reason, by the way, that with certain illiberal groups infiltrating, I've written about this, certain illiberal groups who refuse to assimilate and whose sole purpose is to destroy Europe, actually. He doesn't want that for Hungary. He wants something like a greater Hungary. I don't agree with his philosophy as a more of a cosmopolitan kind of person and pro-immigration person, but I wouldn't put him in as a rogue state. I mean, what has he done? He hasn't slaughtered any, he has certain draconian laws, but he hasn't subjected any of his citizens to slaughter or there's still, as far as I can tell, a due process going on in the state of Hungary. He was elected But that's not a sufficient condition because a lot of rogue thugs have been elected by the citizens. But I would be remiss to sort of include him because not every single authoritarian leader is the head of a rogue state. There have to be other criteria that must be met and that can be demonstrably shown to be committing not just an egregious violation of the rights of their citizens, but also posing a threat to regional stability. So Russia is a rogue state. Russia is definitely a rogue state.
But in that case, we get back to the, maybe morally, we have a right to try to, affect a change of government, but even though there may be political risk, but you can't just, I mean, I guess in some ways you could argue what's happening now in real time, depending on, our involvement in Ukraine and how things are really going over there. But I'm just trying to get a sense of different, which countries qualify, and just as some real world examples. Saudi Arabia, I just wanted to question a little bit. That it seems like, to some degree, they've changed since MBS became the ruler. And I mean, even though he killed that journalist, but at least he's kind of arrested that side of the family that seemed to be more willing to give to terrorist people. There've been some liberal reforms. I mean, does that count for anything?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I think the Wahhabi faith and the commitment of dollars to institutions, including madrasas across Europe, and is still taking place in both Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Qatar is just a big gas station that United States actually needs, but it's not even a country. It's not even a civilization. It's one big giant gas station. It's a monstrosity, and I would argue that one of the mistakes that was made in 9/11, given the fact that 17 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, and given the collusion of Saudi Arabia in cultivating the sensibilities of terrorists across the world, that one of the biggest mistakes that the United States government did not make was to invade Saudi Arabia. Colonize it, annex it, take over its oil fields, and deem it a country completely, it's a medieval kingdom, completely unworthy of it. It's almost living in existing in a sort of quasi state of nature. Take over the whole country. I felt the same way about the war in Iraq. I thought the war in Iraq, on principle, was proper. That is, Saddam Hussein was a cancer in the region that had to be removed, but we unfortunately fought an altruistic war instead of fighting the war that, well, it wasn't a war, but that the imperialists fought in parts of Africa in making alliances with global chiefs and tribal chiefs and so on, and governed actually through those chiefs. And I would just come outright and say, when you're going to war with a country, the goal of the war is to vanquish the enemy. And we sort of, played this altruistic war with Iraq rather than sort of colonizing the country, taking it over, if only temporarily, using the resources to finance the venture itself, and to do what we did with Japan. Look at Japan. I mean, Japan was an imperialistic, horrific empire, and we destroyed it through Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Tokyo firebombings, and we imposed a US constitution, a constitution on it that was suffused with US democratic principles, ending imperialism within a couple of years. We did the same thing with Germany through the Marshall Plan. Now, you could say that we did colonize Japan. That was a form of, we occupied the country. We democratically reformulated it, and then we got out. So this form of ethical recolonization is not a permanent. I'm not advocating like some sort of U.S. new U.S. empire that rivals the British Empire. But I use Japan and Germany as examples to show that it is possible to take rogue states and thug states that have evicted themselves from the ambit of rights and are existing really in a state of nature, and to properly reformulate them, resocialize them, rehabilitate them to some extent if they are, and Germany certainly was, and Japan certainly was. So I don't think what I'm suggesting is all that kooky. I think we colonized Germany for a while, we colonized Japan for a while, we did the business, and then we got out. And the same thing should have been done with Iraq, and the same thing should have been done with Saudi Arabia. Of course, we didn't, and it's not surprising why we didn't. But it's along those, I use Germany and Saudi Arabia, I'm sorry, Germany and Japan as my two examples to show what both military and ethical recolonization can look like, have looked like, and the results that have been produced from them.
I guess one thing that makes me think of, and I do want to encourage people to raise your hand if you want to be part of this, but you brought up the cultural mores, and have we figured out all the cultural mores? It's like when Japan, we already had the New Deal by the time we were helping Japan write their constitution, yet today, you brought up altruism. We're so much more altruistic. I mean, are we even in a position to help someone create something that's not going to be progressive in the first place?
Well, I think it would be terribly morally narcissistic for us to say that we have to get everything right in our own backyard before we can extend the hand of interference or assistance or whatever one, however one wants to sort of characterize it in political terms. That is, we are not so far gone beyond a certain threshold that would disqualify us from the sort of venturesome activities, political venturesome activities that I'm suggesting. We may never get to that perfect state, and no country need get to that perfect state because it's not possible. But the question that's interest that the more interesting question is, are we in a position that would give us the kind of leverage and the kind of authority to act in a certain way? So, in an imperfect world, I think conceptual distinctions have to be made, and in an imperfect world, I think certain activities have to be made even by government actors of a free society that themselves are ensconced in a world or in a country or in a state that is far from being perfect. To wait for a sort of a state of absolute perfection or near perfection, it just seems politically inexpedient to me.
Yeah, and I'm not even saying that we have to wait till we're perfect. It's just at a certain point, the establishment can seem so corrupt that I worry about the advice they'd be giving if they'd just be focused on trans rights more than free markets or something. But I also just going back, I think something that happened in Iraq was that we had this coalition of the unwilling of countries against us, like France and I think Germany and ones that didn't want us to go in. And so that also, I mean, even to the extent that we, I don't know if that just comes under the, what's practical to do at a certain time, but we don't have that one world order, and it's almost like some countries want to be outside what everyone else is doing just to, use that to show off their power.
Right. Well, this was our war, right? We went to Congress, and we went to great lengths to legitimize the war, and President Bush did. And whether one agrees with the manner in which it was done, it was still, it was still a war that was authorized. So this was kind of like our war. It wasn't really Germany's war or France's war. That they didn't come on board, poof, on them, because they're just as much subject as Western countries to the long-term fallout from any kind of damage that Iraq could inflict on the United States. So I'm not even sure that we needed. I'm not even sure that we needed a coalition of a vast coalition of countries to be on board. We certainly did have an international coalition in Iraq. It wasn't we. It was just wasn't our forces. They were reluctant, but there were other allies there with us. I agree, fighting reluctantly and sort of half-heartedly. But I think also, Scott, is this the case, a proper case for, it was a half-hearted, half-baked case for going to war with Iraq. I don't think the moral case was actually made. I think some nonsensical case about potential chemical weapons that could reach America or that could be unleashed America was made. The deeper case that could have been made was that Saddam Hussein was a cancer in that region, and his removal, like all cancers, was absolutely necessary.
Sure. I guess my what I'm thinking is that to the extent that we don't have everyone on board, then it's just us or just these certain countries that are acting as these colonizers to what we determine are rogue states.
Well, I think we can make a case to convince other countries. It's just a matter of leadership and how it's sort of the narrative that we use to, I mean, look, we saw in some sense, though they were not as financially forthcoming with dollars as was America, but we saw in some case the European countries giving steadfast support to Ukraine and siding against Russia. That is understandable given that Russia is in their backyard and they sort of, many of them feared an expansionist agenda on the part of Vladimir Putin, beyond Finland and the Baltic states, actually, that he might have had more expansionist ambitions, or just the fact that never again would want to allow a sort of rapacious thug to pose a kind of threat to civilized Europe as did Hitler. But I guess the point I'm making is that winning the support of other countries requires systematically laying out the foundations for why those countries, in the long run, by promoting regional instability in whatever parts of the world they are truly inimical to a global civilized world order, which ultimately will affect the capacity of countries to trade consistently in a sustainable way, to carry out policies, and so on and so forth. That case has to be made. It's just that, again, US foreign policy in the past 75 years has been so disastrous, so hypocritical, so mixed up that a consistent, I think, rational case has never ever really been presented to our allies as to why they have both the moral right, well, let's just say the moral right of interference, because when the principle of sovereignty has already been dissolved by the countries themselves, and those countries have evicted themselves from the ambit of rights, that any number of solutions, any number of alternatives would be better. Look, I think I want to read something here that, and it's a case in which a couple of African countries. I have it in my notes here. I wasn't prepared to read it, but a couple of African countries. Well, I think it was according to Gili that it wasn't an African country that in 1985 the Indonesian government, fired all of its inspectors, thousands of inspectors at the Jakarta airport, and replaced the corrupt and inefficient customs services with the Swiss firm SGS, and the Swiss rebuilt the customs service, handing back partial control in 1991 and full control in 1997. And Indonesia's exports boomed, right? So this could also be a way of contracting mercenaries and contracting private corporations to do certain, perform certain jobs that are activities that could be sort of contracted out by state actors themselves in these countries, NGOs, various organizations that can actually go into a country and act as political, be authorized to act as political actors in order to bring up these countries to a sort of what I would call a civilizational threshold that's just simply lacking.
Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit to something you said. How can you tell how many are aiding and abetting before, all bets are off and we can just start carpet bombing or what have you?
Well, I think you can look at the voting habits of the voting patterns of citizens of a country, the approval ratings that the leader or the leaders, or usually the leader, enjoys among its citizens. If clearly then a despotic authoritarian tyrant who's leading a rogue nation still has high approval ratings, although that would be one would be hard pressed to find how that could be had consistently when, but let's just use a case of like, I guess at some point, Stalin had very, very high approval ratings during his regime. The people knew nothing more and didn't really have an alternative. But in those countries where there are political competitors, and you can ostensibly show that a political competitor that's a member of one party is offering a different alternative, a different vision, and it's being outright rejected by people who, for some reason, prefer, let's just say, like a Marxist revolutionary despotic government who promises them all sorts of goodies and freebies, and as has been the case in much of decolonized Africa. That's one way I think that you can sort of qualitatively show that there is a case of aiding and abetting, also based on the forms of resistance or lack thereof that is emanating from the rogue state, could be a sign that that they're complicit in the atrocities that are being committed. So I think there are a number of criteria, or criteria is the wrong word. I think there are a number of meaning tests that we could apply to see whether or not citizens of a country are truly aiding and abetting. I mean, I think Iran is a very, very interesting example right now because we're seeing a lot of dissent coming from the young people in Iran who are clearly dissatisfied with the governance to which they're subjected. And we see how these dissenting groups are forming and behaving politically. And so one would be hard pressed to say that there is no resistance at all, that the people of Iran unilaterally completely support the theocracy that the despotic theocracy that is Iran. At some point, though, look, one has to simply bypass anything like that and say that the behavior of the rogue state and the egregious harms that it's inflicting on the region, or the extent to which it's undermining a lasting peace on which the national security of other countries depend, will just have to supersede the efforts or the inclinations of its citizens vis-a-vis whether or not they're complicit or not. It's just one can't sit there indeterminately wringing one hands and watching and hoping that there's going to be a foment, that the fomenting dissent today is going to last in the next, for the next 6 months. I think one has to measure the degree of harm itself that is being inflicted on the region, and that again undermines the capacity of a country like the United States to trade regularly or to conduct policies that are in its national self-interest.
I get that. I think that, you know, just some of that language, it's like, you know, you can see the anarchists considering us to be a rogue state, or that, you know, moral violence is what the wokes accuse us of for not seeing their agendas as the solution to oppression.
Yeah. And there are some people who think 1 + 1 = 6, and we just say you're wrong. They're idiots and they're wrong. And but we don't leave it at that. We ask them, define your terms. What do you mean by violence? And we take their statements to a logical terminal point to shore up the absurdity of it, that if anybody thinks that the United States is a moral equivalent of North Korea or Saudi Arabia, then, you know, without being mean-spirited and saying they deserve to find out the hard way, which I think they do actually, we ask them to lay out a set of terms that are necessary and sufficient to describe a rogue state. And like, what do you mean by violence? Violence in what way? And so we're talking about Saudi Arabia, where homosexuals are beheaded. People are tried there's no due process. Certain parts of Africa, same thing, where, you know, people are just arbitrarily detained without any evidence against them and sentenced to death. So we would have to engage in a very protracted conversation and not just take their self-reportage or their statements or their utterances at face value. We would sit them down calmly, apply reason, logic, evidence, and ask them to explain and define their terms along every step of the way, because I certainly would be able to do that. I would be able to show that a country that beheads homosexuals, that arbitrarily detained, that puts a woman in jail for 34 years, as they did in Saudi Arabia, for tweeting what was considered, I don't know what it was considered, but it was some sort of dissenting ideas that she had about the country, and she's a mother of three and she gets put in jail for 34 years, that there's something ostensibly, putatively, qualitatively different about that state of affairs than someone who commits a crime in the United States of America and is presumed innocent until proven guilty. I mean, there's so many ways of showing the absurdity of these claims. And as far as the woke supremacists are concerned, you would really have to show them that in no other country would their behavior, their ideologies be tolerated, let's say in Iran or Saudi Arabia or North Korea, Russia, parts of Hungary or Hunger itself, and that it's a tolerant state like our constitutional republic, United States of America, that facilitates competing conceptions of the good life. And for some people, you know, living a life of woke supremacy and all that's contained therein is part of the good life, and that America doesn't put these people in jail. We still adhere to the First Amendment and give them the right of free speech. So I think that's an easy one, because that's what I do when I go and give my public lectures, and I meet people who say, you know, we live on stolen land, and if you live on stolen land, then you can't even have a moral conversation. I said, we don't live on stolen land. We live on land that was acquired through treaties and purchases and conquest. And there was a war for resources. The Native Americans came in second. They lost the war. And until the 1924 Indigenous Citizens Act was passed, as far as I'm concerned, they were living as war refugees on conquered land. There is no civilization that was ever, great civilization, that was ever forged outside the crucible of violence and war. And we're not living on stolen land. We're living on conquered land. There was a war for resources and they lost. So there's various ways of just circumventing the arguments of these people and showing the absurdity of the claims that they're making. We don't have to just sort of take it at face value. That would be relativistic. And anyone who thinks that, I'm not a big fan of the former President Bush, but anyone who thinks that he is the equivalent of Adolf Hitler is absurd. No, just sit them down and tell them what Hitler did and ask them to give a counterexample of, or an analogous example of how Trump has behaved in a similar manner. You know, these things just become absurd after a while, and people just are not used to being challenged at a deep and fundamental level. And once you do that, they sort of just, you know, go off into histrionics or they shut up, really.
Bet you run into that a lot in academia.
You do. Oh, I do. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, with the few minutes we have left, can you just ballpark the number of countries you'd consider rogue today out of maybe, what, 200, 220?
Probably no more than really, really rogue states, no. Probably no more than 30.
Okay. But Russia's one of them.
I think Russia's a rogue state. Absolutely.
Okay. Because that ends up being a lot of physical territory of the earth.
Well, unfortunately, but I think the way that Russia has behaved and continues to behave meets both some necessary and sufficient conditions that I've laid out in the four vectors that would qualify as a rogue state. I have another paper that I wrote called Failed States, and failed states, of course, are not the same as rogue states. Although one of the big problems, of course, with failed states, I think, is that they quickly run the risk of falling prey of becoming rogue states for a number of reasons. One is that lacking the kind of economic infrastructure that they do, they fall prey to all sorts of demagogues and despots. But there are failed states that are just like sinkholes. Like if failed states are economic sinkholes, then I would say if failed states are economic sinkholes, I would say rogue states are political and cultural sinkholes that bring down the, just like how a badly kept house brings down the neighborhood's value. These countries bring down the regional prestige and value in which they belong. And it affects everyone ultimately in the long run, I think. As we're seeing those, and we can end here, but as you know, I was part of the debate about defending Ukraine against the Russians. But as we can see, the actions of Russia is affecting Europe in its withholding of certain resources. It'll affect us also. Those actions will inevitably have an effect on the United States of America's economy, maybe not in a great way, as much as, let's say, Germany, that is more dependent on Russia for fuel. But it's certainly going to have some sort of effect on us. And that's why I was making a long, protracted argument that what constitutes a country's self-interest has got to be seen in a very long-range, manner, and not just the fact that, proximally speaking, Russia is very, very far away from America. So what the hell could that, what does that have to do with us? So it has plenty to do with us. When you look at its capabilities and how it can sort of function or behave in relation to its capabilities.
Great. Well, this was very engaging. I'm glad no one else had questions, so I was able to do my own. But tomorrow on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, I'm sorry, make that Friday, Richard Salzman will be here on the topic of recession, essence, cause, and cure. We've also got our gala coming up October 6th in Malibu, honoring Michael Saylor. We're going to have panels with the scholars during the day. It should be very fun. Thanks again, Professor Hill, for doing this, and to everyone who joined us. Have a great evening.